Hello and welcome to another edition of Inquisitive Minds on Brock Radio, CFBU-FM. My name is Mike Saunders, and each week at this time we explore some of the fascinating research being done by Brock University faculty and students, as well as address relevant issues that could impact the Brock community. On today's show, we once again revisit a part of Brock history from 1972, when a Brock research team spent part of that spring at Pond Inlet on Baffin Island, and three undergraduate students had their spring convocation ceremony while still up there. We talked to the second of three graduate students who attended the Arctic Convocation of 1972. We find out about a panel discussion slated for Wednesday evening looking at the current crisis in Ukraine and perhaps what to expect from this weekend's referendum in Crimea. And we hear from a Brock researcher who received a large grant from Compute Canada along with a lot of storage space in order to further his genetic research project. Radio that pushes the boundaries without a fight, Inquisitive Minds, is on the air. We welcome you to another edition of Inquisitive Minds on CFBU-FM. And first of all, apologies for not being here in person last week, but the dreaded winter bug gripped your humble host and still hasn't totally let go. I took a couple of sick days last week, which explains the repeat broadcast from January. But we are back, although a couple of interviews this week and again next week, recorded when I had voice problems thanks to the bug, might sound a little bit different, just so you know. But on with the show. Last month on Inquisitive Minds, we introduced you to one of three Brock geology undergraduates who went up to Pond Inlet on Baffin Island in the spring of 1972 to conduct research on the sea ice in Eclipse Sound in order to aid in designing vessels traveling in the region. Kenneth Blewett still lives up north, as we heard last month, near Yukon in the Northwest Territories. Another of the three who had their spring convocation in May of 1972 atop a dog sled placed on gasoline drums, that was the stage, he joins us on the show this week. Brian Schreiner now lives out west in Saskatchewan and talked to us recently about his memories of that trek up north and what life has been like since he graduated from Brock University in the Arctic over 40 years ago. I asked what he remembered most about that trip up north.
Well, I guess the first impression was it was really cool. And I don't mean just temperature-wise. It was probably an experience of a lifetime, really, to go there and see that barren land. And I hadn't been to the Arctic before, so it was quite barren, but very strong impression of the land. And it looks very beautiful, actually, in many ways. So it was a very unusual experience, that's for sure.
I asked this of Ken as well when I talked to him a couple of weeks ago. What was your first reaction when someone suggested to you, we want to send you up to the Arctic?
I actually embraced the idea. I thought, here's a good chance. Geoscientists are risk takers, I guess, or we like to do new adventures. So I thought it was a great opportunity for me. I was really pleased that I was selected to go as part of the Brock team.
So it really interested you at the time then?
Absolutely. It was a new experience, a new adventure, and, that was what it was all about. But I didn't have much idea what it would be like, but as it turns out, it was a really great experience.
What was the area like when you touched down in the plane? Your first impressions of what you saw, was there a lot of ice, or is that just our preconceived notion of what it's like up there when you get up there in the springtime?
No, it was May, and you might think that's springtime in Saskatchewan and in Ontario, of course, but in the Arctic, it still looks like winter. So it was completely frozen, snow and ice everywhere, everything's white, basically. A little bit of land sticking out here and there, but basically mostly white covered. And so it looks pretty barren when you first get there. And your first impression is, ooh, this is going to be a pretty desolate, lonely experience. But as it turns out, the people there were very welcoming, and it turned out to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the reaction of the people up there, because this would have been something they would never have imagined, that a plane would touch down and a whole bunch of scientists, for want of a better expression, would come off the plane and want to do exploration work up there. So was it a very warm welcome from the people who lived up there?
Yeah, absolutely. And we had been outfitted with parkas and all that gear before we left. But when we got there, the Inuit ladies insisted that they make us proper clothes. So they made us parkas and boots and mitts from seal skin and so on. So they completely refitted us with proper gear. So they took a lot of pride in the event, for sure.
Were they interested as you did the work, as things went along? Were they at all curious about what your findings were?
Yeah, I think so. In one case, we had a young fellow, Caleb Otuva. He was assigned to us as kind of our guide and so on, just for my small team. That was very good. He was very bright and very interested, and he was interested in what we were doing, and we were, of course, very interested in what he knew. So he was very engaging. I found many of the people like that. They were quite friendly and quite curious about what we were up to.
When I talked to Ken recently, he said after the convocation ceremony, everyone in the town literally came over to congratulate all three of you afterwards, which must have made you feel good, the fact that they had really embraced you and the work that you were doing, and they were as proud as you were that this convocation ceremony was underway.
No, that's absolutely true. I mean, it was very unique, of course, and for them, and special for us. As Ken counted, I remember the reception afterwards, and the ladies had prepared a buffet of Arctic char and caribou and seal and baked goods and all kinds of things. And so you could tell it was done in a very respectful way, and almost like we were part of their family. It was a great experience.
Yeah, speaking about the food for a moment, this crossed my mind, the fact that when you get up there, your dietary situation is going to be certainly different from down here. Did that take any adjustment for you?
Well, I remember sampling the seal, and that was quite an experience. It's probably the most rich and very dark, rich meat, and it just explodes in your mouth when you eat it. But other than that, I think most of the food was quite good. And I can't remember exactly, but I believe we also brought in more vegetables and so on with us when they were going back and forth with flights with supplies and so on.
Yeah, I would think up there it would be very difficult to be a vegetarian.
That's not common in a part of the world, that's for sure.
Yes, true. Did all the international attention the convocation garnered surprise you at all?
Well, I was a bit surprised. The first convocation held north of the Arctic Circle, so I suppose that was quite unique. We didn't think it so international. We just thought it was special for us. But then when the article appeared in Time magazine talking about it, I thought, well, I guess that was pretty special. So it turned out it was maybe a short-term international event, but it still got international press.
So was that your only visit north of the Arctic Circle, or have you been back since?
No, I've been in northern part of Canada many places, but not north of the Arctic Circle. So that was my first and only opportunity so far, at least. Maybe I'll still get a chance someday. I'd love to go back there, see how it's changed.
So if you get a lousy spring, for example, wherever you happen to be, presently you're in Saskatchewan, you think to yourself, well, yeah, it's kind of cold. It's not the Arctic Circle. And I know that through experience.
Well, that's true. And I was going to say today it's minus 22 with a wind chill of minus 30, so not that different than being there, really. Maybe it made me accustomed to the Saskatchewan climate, too.
So you graduated from Brock along with Wayne Gesso and Kenneth Blewett back in the spring of 1972. I'm curious to know what life was like for you at Brock back in those days, because we're looking at, what, 1968 to 72?
That's correct, yeah. I spent my 68 to 72 there. I was in the second class of geoscience students for Brock. It was a fairly new program, of course. We were kind of a small class. The senior class, previous class, was still around, of course, and so we got to know all the people there. The classes were probably in the order of 20 students each, so it wasn't a big group. And then we had these great professors, Jan Terrasme, who was mentioned in the article, was our kind of led our Arctic expedition that time, and also was a leading professor for myself at Brock. And then we had other significant profs like Peter Peach. We used to call him Papa Peach because he looked after us like a father. And Bruce Liberty was another professor there. There were several others. They were kind of the major ones. And we were all housed in the renovated bridge factory down below the escarpment. So we were kind of in this isolated setting and very separate from the main campus. Not that the main campus was much at the time. It was basically the tower building, the Schmoan Tower, and that was about all there was there too. But so it was a very intimate environment. So, you know, we got to know each other a lot well and kind of kept in contact with many of the students over the years. So it was an interesting, very intimate experience.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the old refrigerator factory, because as I talk to people who are at Brock in the earlier days, that is the subject that always seems to come up. And in fact, back in the fall, I talked to Dr. John Small, who's out at Queen's University now. He was probably at Brock when you finished up. He would have been on his way in. He was mid to late 70s when he was there. And he said, I remember that old refrigerator factory so well because one of the problems we had there were the rats. He remembered that vividly. What are your recollections of that old building building that, for a lot of people, that was their Brock experience at the time.
I don't know about the rats. I don't remember seeing them, but we did have a science and biology program there, so maybe belonged to that program. I don't know, but I don't remember encountering any myself. So I remember they had a big python in a cage in the hallway one time. We all go there and watch them eat the mice. And
well, that might have solved the problem of the rats right there.
There you go. They were probably the food supply for the...
Maybe the python wasn't there when John was there. That might have been the problem. When you graduated, what did you do with your life after Brock?
First 2 years, when I graduated, that same summer when I convocated, I was married in August, got back from the Arctic in July, and I was married in August to my wife, May, who's also a Brock graduate, English and History. So that started us off there. We spent our first 2 years in Chatham, Ontario, which isn't far from St. Catharines. I worked for consulting firms there, and she was teaching. And then in 1974, I had the opportunity to come to Saskatchewan, to the Saskatchewan Research Council. And I was offered a position to manage this new program they had to basically map the surface geology of northern Saskatchewan. That sounds fairly onerous. And it was, actually. So it was a great opportunity for me, pretty exciting, so I thought that's a good place to get going. It turns out my parents were actually from Saskatchewan originally. They grew up in a small town just about 80 miles east of Saskatoon, so I still had lots of relatives here when I came here, and I hadn't met before, so that was an interesting experience, too. But anyways, I spent the first 6 years mapping in northern Saskatchewan and produced a series of maps and so on, not by myself. We had quite a big team, actually, at the time. And then I worked more in the south part of the province on geology, hydrogeology, things like that over the years. Eventually, I moved more into the management role and supervised various levels. And then I was the VP of two divisions, the environment division and the mining division at one point. And then I was the COO for a year here at SRC. Then I went to the university for 5 years as the assistant to the vice president of research. And that was quite an interesting period of time, especially that was about the time when the Tri-Council funding was boosted a lot, and so there's lots of activity. It was a fun time.
So what are you doing now when you're in Saskatchewan?
I spent 5 years at the university, and then I came back to SRC.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And I came back as the chief geoscientist. So my role is as a technical expert and also kind of an advisor for not only the staff but the management and so on as to new opportunities for in the mining business in particular, but maybe in other areas as well. So that's my current role, and try to build new services and capabilities. And we've actually had a good 5-year run here with some new facilities built and new equipment, and it's been kind of a fun time.
No retirement in the near future for you?
Well, I think about it some days, but still having fun so far, so I think I'll stick it out for a bit longer, but I think I'll know the time when not as much fun to go in the morning. That might be the time to step aside.
So whereabouts in Saskatchewan are you?
Right in Saskatoon. My office is, it's called the Innovation Research Park. It's a big research park that's just north of the university campus, so very nice setting. It's a wonderful environment, and so it's been a fun place.
We touched briefly earlier in the conversation about how cold it is there today, and you'll be glad to know that it's bitterly cold here as well in Niagara. And in fact, I talked to Ken about this because, as you probably know, he lives up around the Yukon. It is a colder than usual winter for us here. And he said, well, we've had winters up here where it's like minus 40 or minus 50, which doesn't make us down here feel any better. But thanks, Ken, for rubbing it in. But anyway, how's your winter been in Saskatchewan?
Well, it's been long and cold. Started basically in mid-November, and we really haven't had much reprieve. That's been the challenge. In other years, you get a little bit of warming up. Not like in Ontario where the snow melts by any means, but just a little bit of relief. This year, it's been pretty steady, so it's been a long time. And last year was kind of cold and long, too, so I think people are getting a little impatient and so on at this point in time.
So the temperature you've got today, is that a good example of a winter's day in Saskatchewan, or is it colder than usual?
It's probably pretty close. It's a little below normal, I would say, on average, but we've had a lot colder days, some days minus 30 or 35 with a wind chill and so on. But it's just been this prolonged cold that's been a drag on everybody, I think, for their patience and their persistence, but hopefully it'll improve.
Welcome to the club. We're all feeling the same way.
Yeah, my mother still lives in St. Catharines, so she tells me the bad weather.
Misery loves company. Have you been back to Brock at all since you graduated?
Not very much recently. The earlier years, I did visit occasionally, try to swing by Brock, but last while I hadn't had a chance to get back. The one memorable event was the Geological Association of Canada had their annual meeting at Brock. It's quite a number of years ago now. I don't remember exactly when. But anyway, I went to the meeting there at Brock, and I remember there was an awards luncheon in the refectory called the Pond Inlet Refectory. And I remember sitting there, and the representative from Brock, who was kind of the host, talked about Pond Inlet and how the name was derived and how this convocation occurred in 1972. And so when he was done, I stood up and said, by the way, I was one of those graduates. So that was a fun time to be the real person in the room.
And I was at Pond Inlet just 2 days ago for an event up at Brock, and it looks as idyllic even in the winter as it would the rest of the year. A little colder, but still quite peaceful and idyllic. And in fact, I talked to one person, I didn't realize this, who had been at Brock for a long, long time. She said, we were married out there just beyond the glass doors of Pond Inlet, and we had our wedding pictures taken there as well.
Yeah, it's a very nice setting, and I thought it was very appropriate because where the convocation was performed, it was in a little cove east of the village itself, and quite pristine and quite quiet and comfortable. It looks very reminiscent of what you see there in the winter, of course, not in the summer, but...
Absolutely.
But it's a great place. I'm always very pleased that they used that name and kept that memory going. It's been a good memory for myself and Ken and Wayne, I'm sure, for years.
If you could say one thing you remember about your time when you were at Brock as a student, what would it be?
Good question. It's hard to capture all the feelings, I think, but I actually felt very comfortable, I guess, and very content and satisfied. I wasn't really sure what I was going to do when I first went to university, and I took a general first year, of course, and then discovered geology, and I realized then that geology was kind of my passion or my gift or my desires. So that's where I took off, and then after that I felt very comfortable, very satisfied with where I was going, and it turns out I had a fairly decent career out of geology and that whole experience, so it's been great.
And it continues to this day.
And it does continue to this day.
Does it seem like 50 years ago that Brock got started to you?
It does not. Well, I said that to my wife that I was going to do this interview. She said, whoa, it doesn't seem that long ago. No, it's funny. Like I said before, my memories of those experiences are probably a little clearer than the ones I did last week. So it just stays in your mind, I think.
You're not alone when you think about that, though. Thank you very much, Brian, for your time today. I appreciate you reminiscing with us, and we're trying to look at opportunities to celebrate and reminisce about the earlier years at Brock periodically here on the program, and I thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
That was Brock alumni member Brian Schreiner from the graduating class of 1972, one of three students who attended their spring convocation while doing research in the Arctic at the real Pond Inlet that spring. Brian now lives in Saskatchewan. Much has been written and talked about regarding the current crisis in Ukraine. The pending vote this weekend to determine if the Crimean region should return to being a Russian territory once again is foremost in the discussion. But what brought us to this point? What's the history of Crimea, and why is it being used as essentially a pawn in a political chess match that could have perhaps dire consequences? A group of professors at Brock University will host a public panel discussion Wednesday evening on the political crisis in Ukraine. The professors will share their perspectives and historical contexts on the ongoing situation in the Eastern European country, from the deployment of Russian troops in Ukraine to the Crimean autonomy referendum scheduled for Sunday. One of the participants will be Yuri Dreifelts, an associate professor of political science of Latvian origin, who specializes in Russian and Ukrainian politics. I asked Professor Dreifelts, who else will be on the panel with him?
Yeah, well, we have a diverse panel in a sense that we have a Russian from Moscow, Professor Viktor Avdeyev, who is now a visiting professor at Brock University teaching Russian history. We also have a Ukrainian origin professor, Bogdan Nebesio, who is an associate professor of communication and popular science and film at Brock. Then Professor Charles Burton in the Department of Political Science, and a specialist on Chinese politics, who in fact also speaks and reads Chinese. And myself, Yuri Dreifelts, I teach political science, and I have a regular course on Russian, Ukrainian, and former Soviet politics, country politics.
So it's going to be a real mix on the panel.
Well, we hope so. I mean, we try to provide a kind of amplitude, because otherwise I think the problem is that our media presents a fairly warped vision of what is happening, and so does the Russian media, and they have a totally different take on it. In reality, you know, in between, some parts of their stuff is correct but mostly wrong, and our part is also mostly right but still wrong in certain parts. So there it is.
Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about that, because I think there's a tendency in this social media world that we live in now to jump to conclusions about events such as we see unfolding in the Ukraine. Rather than take a more lengthy approach to gathering the facts about the situation, we look for quick sound bites or quick internet hits and make our judgments from there. So I presume with the panel, you're going to be presenting both sides of the situation and in a lengthier format where you can base your opinions on more information rather than less.
Well, we hope so. And I think this is why we have the Russian professor and Ukrainian professor, so to provide a kind of different poles of opinion. But at the same time, because we are, I think, very polite, I don't think we'll have the kinds of conflicts that we find in the Ukrainian and Russian parliaments, where they tear each other's hair out and throw water at each other and so forth. No, we're going to be fairly calm and collected, but I think we want to bring out the facts. And indeed, we might come to certain consensus. I wouldn't be surprised. So come and see and listen.
I read an editorial on the weekend that suggested the West, by and large, has essentially accepted the manipulation of history in the case. Basically, according to the Russians, Crimea is a traditional Russian territory with an overwhelming Russian population that was transferred to Ukraine by Khrushchev back in 1954. So we're really not getting both sides of the story here, I suspect.
Well, you know, the side of the story, okay, 1954, it was transferred, and it really didn't mean much because, of course, the Soviet Union was ruled by one single party, so just transferring one region to another region didn't change a lot. But of course, as soon as Ukraine became independent, it was a major territorial gain for Ukraine and a loss for Russia. What I found interesting is back in the 1990s, the Russian Duma already pronounced itself that they want Crimea back. But at that time, Yeltsin and people in charge, of course, realized that this wouldn't be, an easy thing to do, one. And they also didn't want to open up a can of worms, because so many of the parts of Russia are what you might call territories that were taken from other countries. So, for example, Finland lost Karelia, and now it is part of Russia. But what if Finland wanted to take Karelia back? And Japan lost the Northern Islands. And of course, they're still demanding them back. A lot of remaining unsolved border problems, which I think might unravel with this issue of Crimea. So I think Putin is stepping perhaps on a banana peel, not knowing it, because, as I said, it's a slippery slope. And the other thing, of course, is now that the right of Crimea to separate and to become independent or join Russia, well, then what's to prevent Chechnya, which is now part of Russia, or its neighbor Dagestan or Ingushetia, from demanding the same rights of self-rule or independence that Crimeans are demanding? So it's a complicated question. And again, you know, why would Putin want Crimea? I think it's a sort of geopolitical strategy, but otherwise it's a big burden, because Crimea is not self-sustaining. Generally, I think Ukraine at this point in time is an economic basket case, largely brought about by the total control of its economy by these oligarchs. You know, so the top half hundred or 50 oligarchs, or rich people, as they're called, control roughly about 85% of Ukraine's economy. And they, of course, are not putting back money into new equipment and so forth, but buying big villas and houses in London, for example. Look at one of the top oligarchs, Viktor Pinchuk, who married the daughter of the former president of Ukraine, Kuchma. Now, they just bought a $60 million house in London. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian economy is going bankrupt. So I think this really points the finger at this total corruption. And I think what happened, of course, after Yanukovych fled, we saw the gold-laced toilets and the huge private zoos and whatnot that this president had amassed for himself, again indicates the scope of this corruption. That's why, even if Yanukovych comes back, and I am one who says that he should come back, simply to keep what you might call Ukraine borders intact, but he would never win anymore. And I think this is our trump card, because once people have seen the lavish lifestyle, the 12 most expensive cars in his garage in the world, all kinds of Mercedes, Benzes, and whatnot, I think appetite for Yanukovych is gone. But that still doesn't change some of the aspects of which I am very critical about, and that's the takeover of power. It was short-circuited. Most people don't realize because it happened so quickly. On February 21st of this year, the foreign ministers of Poland, France, and Germany signed an agreement with the president of Ukraine, Mr. Yanukovych, about changes, early elections, changing the constitution, and having a unity government. 24 hours later, you find this coup managed by gun-toting individuals. This is not the way to go if you think of rule by law. And another thing is that this new parliament came together and claimed that Yanukovych should be impeached. And they impeached him technically, but the Constitution says that a president can only be impeached if the Constitutional Court agrees. So the Constitutional Court, which is made up of 18 individual judges, 6 of which had been appointed by the president, 6 by parliament, and 6 by collegium of judges, that's the proper way to go. And I would suggest, really, that if we want to impeach Yanukovych, we should get the official constitutional process and go through it. Now, the reasons given by the present Ukrainian parliament and office holders to impeach Yanukovych were 2. One, that he had abandoned his post. Well, he abandoned his post because he was being shot at. You know, I think most of us would get the hell out if we were being threatened. And the second was the shooting in the square, Independence Square, where you had these snipers who were firing both at the police and the demonstrators. Now, we don't know who these snipers are at this point. It's a question mark. But the parliament accepted the fact that this was Yanukovych's doing. Well, you know, there are different interpretations. So, indeed, what was interesting is the hacking of the conversation between the Estonian foreign minister and the EU foreign minister, where the Estonian claims that he heard versions which indicated that perhaps the part of the armed demonstrators themselves had organized the shootings in order to create the atmosphere for a putsch or takeover or a coup d'etat, as it's called. So there are a lot of unknowns. You know, I don't claim to be on one side or the other, but I do have questions. I'm not happy with the explanations. And if anything, when Yanukovych gave a speech today that he wants to come back, I would say, let him come back. And he can run in the election, but he's not going to win. But at least I know from his speeches that he's as much a Ukrainian, he's corrupt, of course, but he's also a Ukrainian who doesn't want the Crimea to leave. So in that sense, we could play him against the Crimean separatists at this point in time. But, of course, I have no power, and nobody listens to my advice, so there it is.
Even if he came back, I mean, yeah, you could play him as a card against the forces that want Crimea to leave. How much power does he have now, though? He has no credibility in the eyes of Ukrainians, seeing the lifestyle that he led. What is there to gain for him if he comes back?
Well, I think that he could calm down the Russian speakers in Ukraine, who are mostly concentrated in the eastern part of Ukraine and also the Crimea. Now, what happened was, I think, a bad move by the present, what do you call, parliament or Duma, is that the first law they passed was to abrogate or do away with the law which allowed regions to make Russian and Ukrainian both an official language in areas where more than 10% of the population was Russian. And that, of course, sent a bad message. Now, it's true that the president, or the temporarily appointed president, had said that he would veto this law. But the message was sent. And involved in all of this, of course, is the presence of an interesting party, a nationalist party, Svoboda. Now, Svoboda translates as Freedom Party. Freedom Party has a strange history. Initially, they were what you might call very right-wing, intolerant, Ukraine for the Ukrainians. Their particular, what you might call, platform indicates that only Ukrainians should work in the Ukrainian bureaucracy, and also, of course, to make Ukrainian the only official language, and eventually to do away with the Russian schools. So this was a threat to those people who, of course, don't speak Ukrainian in eastern parts of Ukraine. So the Svoboda Party is nationalist party, which is okay, because Ukraine needs a dash of nationalism. But at the same time, intolerant nationalism is not the way to go. And I find the same thing is true for Crimea. The new mobilized radicalized Russians in Crimea. They're starting to work against the 15% to 20% who are Tatars. Indeed, the Tatars were the original inhabitants of Crimea. They're called Crimean Tatars. And Stalin deported most of them in 1944 to Kazakhstan and other places. 50% died along the way. But then back in the 1990s, they started coming back. And of course, their houses were occupied by the new Russian occupiers. But they still settled around the cities and so forth. So now these Russians already marking the houses which belong to the Tatars, which leads me to think that there might be an inner potential clash between the Tatars and the Russians. And of course, there's also 25% Ukrainian population who might not exactly be in accord with these Russian separatists, the Ruzhinkis that carry guns, you know, fat slobs with guns. Okay, that's the way I see them.
Yeah, the Tatars seem to be the forgotten people in all this. They were the original inhabitants of Crimea.
That's right. Well, it's too bad in a sense, and you know, but at the same time, you see, if the Tatars are going to be targeted, I think there might be repercussions in Russia itself. They're Muslims, and remember that the North Caucasus, Chechnya, Dagestan, and the other North Caucasus republics are mostly Muslim as well. And then there's Tatarstan, which is made up of Tatars. So Tatarstan is a big chunk of Russia, just north of Kazakhstan, and if they proceed with this kind of anti-Tatar program, I think the long-term implications might be quite severe for Russia. The Tatars have a claim, but you know how it is with history. I mean, the Indians have a claim to Canada and certain cities, but I think hats off to our Canadian governments. They have allowed native peoples now to reclaim what was taken away from them. And so we have the courts and I think 120, 130 ongoing cases of territorial disputes in Canada, which I think is the proper way to go.
Okay, but, well, two things about Crimea. What was the reason for Khrushchev essentially gifting Crimea to Ukraine in the first place in 54? And in today's situation, why is Crimea viewed as such a prize to acquire? It doesn't appear to be that great a prize to gain.
Well, I think partly, of course, you have to realize that Crimea is attached to Ukraine by a narrow sort of strip of land, but it's not attached to Russia. So there was a sea gap in between. That's one factor. Secondly is Khrushchev was of Ukrainian origin as well. So, and the third fact was a kind of showmanship for 300 years of friendship between the Ukrainian peoples and the Russian peoples. You know, Russia will give this as a kind of present. So that's the reasoning. So yeah, it's one of those things, historical things, that now has come back to haunt the Ukrainians and the Russians.
Now, you were saying earlier that because of the economic situation, I mean, Russia is not exactly flush with cash. The Olympics notwithstanding, the lavish spending that we saw with the Sochi Games recently. But I mean, Russia is not exactly on a solid financial footing themselves, from what I can see.
No, they're not. Indeed, I think last year, economic growth was somewhere close to 0%, in contrast to previous years. And I think also the oil prices are not going up very rapidly, and 60% of Russia's governmental budget is dependent on oil and gas revenue. So, you know, they're nervous. And yes, why would they want that? Well, it's strategic. They do have a Black Sea fleet there, and I think that they were nervous that the Svoboda Party, the Freedom Party, that has in fact become part of the government of the present Ukraine, and one of the Svoboda people is now defense ministers, and in their own platforms, they've indicated they want to get rid of the Russian Black Sea Fleet's port in there. So in a sense, it's self-defense for Russia. That's part of it. The other thing to remember is it has potential. Crimea is the Florida of that part of the world. You know, palm trees. People who remember history remember that Yalta agreements were held in that part of Crimea. So yeah, they had palm trees and warm weather and also beaches. So there's potential for tourism. But, you know, not enough, I think, to counteract the drain on the economy. In the long run, if Crimea goes, it might be good for Ukraine. Pardon me for saying this, but Yanukovych won by 500,000 votes in contrast to Yulia Tymoshenko, who was sort of Western-oriented. And if you take away the 1,000,000 votes he gained in Crimea, Yulia would have won. So in a sense, the drain on Ukraine by this particular peninsula is quite formidable, ideologically and ethnically and so forth. So by losing over 1,000,000 Russian speakers, speakers who are antagonistic towards the Ukrainian government and don't want to learn Ukrainian, it might be a good thing in the long run. But I hate to talk to my Ukrainian friends after this, but it's just my view.
So given the vote that's coming up, the referendum on Sunday, depending on which way it goes, if they vote to join Russia, what happens to the Ukrainians? Do they have any recourse at this point, or they just have to accept it?
Well, it's a tough call. The present temporary government in Kiev, which is the capital city of Ukraine, has indicated that they might send the army in. But, of course, that's a very lopsided situation if the Russians decide to counter. If the Russians stay aside, well, then it would be maybe a week's worth for the Ukrainian army. But I don't think this will happen. At present, it seems to me that the signal has been given from Moscow that they should demand independence rather than joining Russia, which of course makes it easier for Russia because then they don't have to pay all those extra pensions and subsidies and whatnot. And, you know, Krim, as it's called in Russian, or Crimea, will in fact suffer alone. So who knows? You know, it's so difficult to tell at this point. And I'm not sure about Putin's... I think I agree with Angela Merkel of Germany that he's not all there. He's, you know, he's playing chicken, or shall we say, he's throwing matches in a sort of a gunpowder room. You know, anything can happen. I mean, if the Ukrainian officers had not been so self-contained and self-controlled, we could have had a war now. But they paced themselves. They did not allow the Russian gun-toting individuals to essentially start a war. But it could start. I mean, you know, young people with guns on both sides, you know what happens. Bang, bang, and you're dead. And next thing you know, countries are involved. And remember, Sarajevo, which is not that far from in Serbia, Sarajevo, at least part of the Yugoslavia, was the place where World War I started after one assassination of an archduke. So things can happen. And we don't want these. I'm sure nobody wants a world war. I don't think we even want a regional war. But let's pray for the best. Let's hope that people can keep their cool and decide on the outcome by discussion. And this is why, myself, I include the point that it might be nice if we return back to the February 21st agreement, which was ignored, and the Western countries afterwards ignored as well. They did sign it. An irony, of course, is that Russia did not sign at that time, but now is asking that we go back to the February 21st. First agreement. So, you know, it's interesting how the sort of historical wheel turns.
So what happens if it goes the other way and they decide, Crimea decides to stay with Ukraine? Could there be a backlash from Russia then? Would it be in their best interest to do that, or just say, okay, you've made your decision, we'll abide by it?
Well, put it this way, I think the signals come directly from Moscow. So if Moscow wants Crimea to stay in Ukraine, it will happen. They will stuff the ballot boxes if they need, but this will happen. So it's really up to Moscow. And I think at this point, the signals are from Moscow that let Crimea be independent, and it's a kind of maybe more peaceful step than joining Russia. And they can join Russia later if they want, and if the Russians want. You know, there are all kinds of connotations, because remember that one of the reasons that the whole problem started was that Putin wanted Ukraine to join the Eurasian Economic Common Market, so to speak. And right now they have Kazakhstan, they have Belarus, they also have some of the other countries, but they wanted Ukraine. And the European Union offered a kind of associate state status for Ukraine. Well, you know, Yanukovych was essentially a fence sitter. We didn't know which way to jump. Then Russia offered the equivalent of $15 billion of credit and also lowered the gas prices by one-third, which, of course, it's a very, very tempting offer, which Yanukovych was contemplating accepting and, in fact, jumping into the Putin kind of Eurasian market. But now, I think, if the strains continue, Kazakhstan might also feel threatened by Russia. These are the implications, and other countries also feel threatened. The argument by Putin that we have to go and save the Russians outside our borders, that's a pretty formidable statement. I mean, is he going to save the Russians in Brighton Beach in the United States, you know, if they don't like something? Or how about Latvia and Estonia and other countries? Latvia has about a 30% Russian population, does that give Putin the right to step in because, you know, they're complaining about this, that, or the other? I would say 100% no, but they seem to claim otherwise. And this is why the NATO planes have been sent to the Baltic states to provide more confidence to the Baltic population that we're not abandoning you. Unfortunately, Ukraine, for Ukraine's sake, of course, they're not in NATO, and the NATO rules don't apply, which means, of course, that if one is attacked, everybody chips in. But Ukraine, unfortunately, was only an associate player in some cases with NATO, but it was not a member of NATO.
A proverbial can of worms indeed.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and you're going to be discussing this Wednesday afternoon at Brock, weather permitting.
Weather permitting at Thistle 248. So if anybody wants to join us and ask tough questions, I think we have the people who can probably answer them, including a representative from Moscow.
Professor Dreifels, thank you very much for coming in today.
I'm glad to be here.
And that was Yuri Dreifels, an associate professor of political science at Brock, specializing in Russian and Ukrainian politics. Recently, Compute Canada, the country's national platform of high-performance computing, or HPC, resources, announced grants of more than $134 million worth of state-of-the-art computing, storage, and support resources allocated to 271 leading-edge Canadian research projects across the country. Two such grants are directed towards research currently being done at Brock University. Over $31,000 and 320,000 processor hours granted to Stuart Rothstein, and almost $272,000 and 630,000 processor hours and 170 terabytes of storage granted to our next guest, Ping Liang. Ping Liang is Associate Professor, Biological Sciences, Faculty of Mathematics and Science at Brock, and he joined us in our CFBU studios recently to talk about the grant and some of the research he's conducting at Brock. And I asked him how significant this grant is to the work he's doing.
It's essentially critical because what we do really completely rely on those kind of high-performance computing facilities. So it's really lucky that we have the access to this kind of facilities.
Now, for those not familiar with Compute Canada, and I wasn't, is this a national computing resource that universities across the country would tap into, as it were?
Yes, it is. This is a relatively new organization. It's built based upon several major local high-performance computing consortiums. The one we are blocked belong to is called ShockNet, which actually involves more than 20 institutions, mostly universities in southern Ontario.
Now, basically, I would imagine their computer resources can perform much larger and much more complex duties than any computer that a university could afford to have on campus, I presume.
That's right. Basically, what they have is pool all the money. Actually, they got funding from CFI, the Canadian Foundation of Innovations, to purchase those equipment. I mean, the system they have is so large. Just for example, one of the systems we have at ShockNet called Orca, or CA, has over probably 3,000 computer loads and a lot of storage space. And so I don't think any individual university would have this kind of resources.
So is this sort of like the computer HAL from the movies years ago, a big behemoth that only a few have real access to?
Pretty much like that.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm looking at your grant size, and beyond the monetary value, you've got 630,000 processing hours and 170, I presume we're talking terabytes, of storage needs. Now that, to me, sounds like an awful lot. So realistically for you, how long is that storage going to last you?
Actually, I already used up the storage I was allocated.
Really?
Yeah, so this is mainly because of the type of research I'm involved. It just involves a massive amount of data.
So when I've got a 2 terabyte backup on my computer at home and you're working with 170 and you've already filled that, that's massive.
It is.
That's a lot of data.
Yeah. So just give you one example how much data we're talking about. So the data I'm working with is called whole genome sequencing of humans. So the way that we generate the data for human genome sequence, each of us have 3 billion base pairs. You can roughly convert to 3 gigabytes of text data. And we have to actually sequence them like 30 to 100 times. So basically, one genome for one individual comes down to about 300 gigabytes of data. And now I'm working with thousands and thousands of the genome data. So if you time 300 by thousands, so that's like 300 terabytes of data already.
So you're going through it like crazy.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, now looking at the Compute Canada computer system and what it can accommodate. Now it says here, what I was reading, Compute Canada resources represents close to, is it petaflops? 2 petaflops?
Yes. Yeah,
okay, of compute power, which is equal to 2 quadrillion calculations per second. Not in an hour, a second. This is unbelievably huge. And more than 20 petabytes? Is it petabytes?
Yeah.
Okay, petabytes. 20 petabytes of storage, equivalent to more than 400 million four-drawer filing cabinets filled with text. Now, the first thing when I read that is 400 million four-drawer filing cabinets doesn't sound like a heck of a lot given the storage size, but maybe it is. But anyway, compared to a terabyte, for example, how big is a petabyte? How big are we talking here?
I think that's a thousand of terabytes. A petabyte is a thousand of terabytes.
And so you had 170 of those.
Yeah.
Wow. So a petaflop is how big?
Well, actually, I'm not quite into that part.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Just curious because I just enjoy saying petaflop. It's one of those terms that I don't know who came up with that, but they deserve a Nobel Prize for humor, I think.
Right.
So we're talking really big here. No wonder universities don't have access to this kind of power and storage on their own. I gather, as we said earlier, a university just doesn't have the resources to have this on site. You have to send it out elsewhere.
Yeah. Just a few years back, I have my little own servers on the campus. I have, I think, a storage server about just maybe under 20 terabytes. And I was told I have the largest storage server on the campus. But of course, that's like 3 years back.
Yeah. And you've been growing since then. So you're probably still in the lead.
I think so, yeah. Yeah. We actually upgraded several times after that.
Now, how does it work then? You send the data up to Compute Canada and they run the data through the system for you? Or do you have an access to the system down here so that you can do it yourself?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the way it works is the data I'm getting, I'm using is mostly from public domains, and they are available online from several major data repositories. One of the particular one that is major for us is the one at the National Center of Biotechnology Information at the States. So we download most of the data from their site. But in some other cases, we have data of our own or from our collaborators. So in this case, we'll have to upload our data from our campus to the ShackNet systems.
Now, let's talk about what research you're doing that benefits from the sheer compute power that you were awarded by Compute Canada. How will your work be affected by this?
Basically, without this system, it's not feasible at all to get it done for the kind of scale of the project I'm working with. It's going to take my own little server, maybe, I don't know, tens of years to get it done.
Where you're sending the information, where does it go, Ottawa, or whereabouts in the country?
It's actually, so Compute Canada is a network of local, several local high-performance computing consortiums. So the one we are working with mostly is the ShackNet. It's actually located on several university campuses. One is, I believe, is Waterloo, and one is Guelph, and one is at McMaster's, and also probably a few systems on Weston's. We used to have one on Brockenridge campus, but they actually now trying to consolidate the systems just as a way to improve the efficiency for management. So they moved Hunt, one of the systems we have, from Brock to, I believe, London.
Okay. Yeah. Now, here's the $64,000 question. You have to explain to me in layman's terms what genome structural variants are and why we need to know about them.
Yes. Okay, so each of us, as human beings, like any other organisms, we are different from each other. We are unique in the way we look at, and then also this is because we are also unique in terms of the genetics. So all genetic makeup for each individual is unique, is different from each other. So the goal of all research is really trying to find what are the genetic differences among us and how is the genetic difference relate to how we differ physically or in terms of medical applications. So by being able to understand what's the level of differences we have in our genomes, and we will be able to gradually figure out, convert those differences into how we look and how we behave and how we respond to diseases and how we respond to treatment as well.
So every living organism has a different makeup, is what you're saying.
That's right.
Now, for you on the inside, working with this day to day, maybe that doesn't sound as mind-blowing, if you'll pardon the expression, as it does to me. Because, I mean, we're talking all these different species on the Earth, and every single one of them is different.
That's correct.
It's phenomenal when you look at it that way, that obviously, you know, everything is going to be different, but everything, not just some groups, but everything is different.
Absolutely right.
Wow. Now, you're Canada Research Chair in Genomics and Bioinformatics. That's a big one. And you are particularly interested in a class of genetic components called transposable elements. And I wanted to find out a little bit more about that, because they do exist and evolve actively in the genomes for most organisms, including humans. So essentially, by transposable, I presume you're talking about data being transferable from one organism to another. Am I correct in assuming that?
In some sense, there are situations like that. But the ones we are talking about here is a type of DNA elements in our genome that can jump from one place to another within the genome, not across different cells.
Yeah, I was going to ask about, do they have to be the same species of organism?
Here we actually talk about within the same cells, from one spot of the chromosome to another spot of the chromosomes.
Okay. Now, yeah. I'm reading about genetic diversity derived from transposable elements and studies of the impact of gene function and phenotype using human and grapevine models. And I was interested by the juxtaposition of human and grapevine models because, I mean, we're talking two different things there. So there's a similarity between the two.
Yes, the way that it works in the genome is pretty much the same. Of course, the major type of transposable elements are slightly different from like animals or, for example, humans. But the basic mechanisms are the same. Actually, I want to share with you one good example of how transposable elements impact the phenotype of organisms. Is that the grapevines, or the grapes we have, we know we have the red grapes and the white grapes, right? And the color change, actually, in this case, was exactly because of the transposable elements.
Oh, okay. Now, the information that you find out, since we are in wine country here, is that information that you're able to derive from your research of any use to the wine growers in the area? Are they able to take some of that information and make use of it themselves? Or is it just an interesting comparison, but you can't go beyond that?
Well, at this stage, I think what's more useful is for us to understand the genetic basis of the property of different wine varieties. I know some of them, or my guess is some of those differences is probably due to the transposable elements.
Okay, so where does all this take you? This may seem like a really obvious question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. How do we benefit, the average person on the street, how do we benefit from your research?
Right, that's a big question for us too. I guess one major area is the medical applications of the knowledge we generate. So here we're trying to understand the genetic basis of our individual. So by understanding the genetic differences we have, and then with the technology available today, which is going to be able to allow us to afford to have everybody's genome sequenced. And so by having your whole genome sequence available in front of the doctors, and also the knowledge associated with those sequences, so your doctor is able to tell you down the road what kind of risk you're subject to in terms of a different type of disease, or if you are in the middle of medical problem, health problems, maybe the doctor is able to come up with the best treatment or drugs for your problems. So that's the ultimate goal of human genomics at this moment.
We talked before we started the interview with the fact that Brock is celebrating the 50th anniversary this year, and that coincidentally is your 50th year as well. So it's a nice harmonic convergence, if you will, that you were born in the same year as Brock. So That must make you feel good that you're here for their 50th anniversary season.
Yeah, this was really an interesting finding, and that makes me much closer to Brock.
And you've been to other universities prior to coming to Brock, but you've been here since 2008. So I may be tempting fate by asking this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Are you here for a nice long run?
I hope so. I hope this is going to be my last job until retirement, because I really like the region and also the university environment we have.
It's a wonderful and, I find, stimulating environment. Everyone I talk to on campus and beyond the campus of Brock, fascinating people to get to know, but they're also very nice, and I really like that. It's important that you get to find the people are just genuinely great people to get to know. And I really enjoy the conversations I have with everyone up at Brock because I just meet so many interesting people who have different things to talk about. And they all come from different walks of life. This is the fascinating thing. Like, for example, with you. You came over from China years ago. About what, 20 years ago, you said?
Yeah, just a little over 20 years ago.
And then you find your way to Brock, and here you are during their 50th anniversary year. So, Ping Liang, we thank you very much for coming in and talking to us. This is fascinating research. It's making me want to learn a lot more. So you've planted the seed.
Thank you very much for having me. By the way, I just wonder if I can use this opportunity to do a little commercial.
Sure.
Yeah. If you are one of the listeners on the campus or anywhere else, you happen to listen to this one, and if you happen to have the training or skills in both biology and computer programming or computer science, or if you don't have both of them, but you have the interest or you have the confidence that you can learn the other one, I would encourage you to approach me to talk about possibly doing a graduate program in this area. So you can reach me by email at pling@brockhu.ca, or if you're on campus, you can stop by Mackenzie Charles F. Block 216, I believe.
And do you want to give your phone extension? You might as well give all the information.
It's 5922, sorry.
I always have trouble when I get up to Brock finding my way around. So it makes me feel better that the phone extension trips you up.
This is the one you use list.
Exactly. Yeah. It's on your business card, but you rarely actually look at it and have to tell people. Anyway, Professor Liang, thank you for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I told you my voice would be a little bit different. You'll hear it again in the next 2 or 3 weeks, as a matter of fact. And there we heard from Ping Liang, an associate professor with the Biological Sciences Faculty of Mathematics and Science at Brock, about a Compute Canada grant that is helping him with his extensive research into genomics. Well, that's it for this edition of Inquisitive Minds on CFPU-FM. I think I've done enough damage for today. My name is Mike Saunders. I hope you've enjoyed the show. You can contact me via email at any time at talk@cfpu.ca with show comments and suggestions. Until next week, always remember to have an inquisitive mind. Thank you.